The pasuk says in Parshas Re'eh, Anochi Nosim Lefnei Hamayom Bracha U'Klala. See that I've put in front of you today Bracha and Klala. Meaning I've given you a choice. You can choose Bracha or you can choose Klala. Esa Bracha, Shir Tishmo, Mitzvot Hashem Elokeichem. There's a Bracha. If you listen to the Mitzvot of Hashem, your God, Asher Anochi Mitzvot Hashem Hamayom, that I command you today. That's if you listen to the Mitzvot, then that's the Bracha. The Klala is in Los Tishmo Klala Mitzvot Hashem Elokeichem. It's you don't listen to the Mitzvot of Hashem, your God. But Sartim in the Dark, Asher Anochi Mitzvot Hashem Hamayom, you turn from the path that I commanded you to do today, and you go after other gods that you did not know or you had nothing to do with. Now that this choice of choosing between good and bad, between good and evil, is really a choice that we make a bracha on every single morning. It's the bracha that it gives the mind the ability to differentiate between day and night, meaning the differentiation between something good and something that's bad. I'm sorry? Yes, Sechvi also is translated as rooster, which is another thing altogether, why a rooster is translated as one's brain. But there's a connection, because it's also called a gezer. There's an idea behind that. But sometimes we make mistakes. Obviously, we make the wrong decision. We decide to do something bad. We choose the wrong path. And that's a sad reality. The fact is, we do make wrong decisions. Our job is to sit there and work hard and realize that the klala isn't God's doing, so to speak, that God is just punishing us for something that we didn't do or just doing bad things to us for no reason whatsoever. Rather, it's a result, it's a consequence from a decision that I made and something that I came up with. That's the idea behind a klala. That I look at this situation and I say, I chose badly. I chose to do something that was the wrong decision, and therefore, I am going to be punished for what I've done. This is the idea of re'eh. Re'eh means to see something, to look at something, and to say to yourself, I've done something wrong, I've made the bad decision, and therefore I'm being punished. Says the Me'ah Shiloh, the Ishbitzer. It's very easy for a person to go ahead and say, and this is what everybody does. When something good happens, I did it. Kochi ba'otzem yadi asas achel ozeh. I'm the one who was involved, who got everything done. And when something bad happens, that wasn't me, that was God. I blame God for everything bad that had happened. It's very easy for a person to do such a thing. And the fact is that a person has to look at it equally. That God is in charge of everything, and it's due to different decisions that I make. When bad things happen, it's something that I might have done wrong. When good things happen, it's something that I might have done right. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved in everything, and it's not just me, and it's not just God. That's the idea behind the Me'ah Shiloh, and that's the reason for the word re'eh, more than any other place in the world. This is the idea behind seeing what you've done wrong. Now that's one thing. That's the Chiddush HaRim, and as well as the Me'ah Shiloh, the Ishbitzer. But there's another reason for A. The Or HaChaim says that Moshe Rabbeinu was telling Klal Yisrael, you want to be able to choose wisely, you want to be able to make the right decision, look at me. Look at my face and see how I act. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu happened to be a very unique individual. He was a gibor, a very, very strong man. We know that he's the one that defeated Og. He jumped 10 amos. He jumped his own height. Nobody jumps their own height except an ant. there's nothing like that can jump as high as they are tall. It's just ridiculous. There's no way that somebody could do such a thing. It's such a concept of how strong Moshe Rabbeinu was. Aside from that, he was a tremendously rich person. He had the sapphire that he had found underneath his tent that he used to make the second luchos out of. Moshe Rabbeinu was an unbelievably rich person, possibly the richest person in all of Klal Yisrael except for Korach. That's a Gemara in the Darim Daf Lamed Chasam and Aleph. Aside from that, he was a king. It's a Medrash Tanchuma and Korach. He had the status of a melech. He was a nasi in regular terms, but he was a melech, a pure king in what he did and how he acted. That's another type of idea out there, as well as being a great man, just a tremendously great man who had the greatest of midos. That's a Kalalas Rabba. There's never been anyone like Moshe Rabbeinu in that type of regard, and somebody who's able to work on his midos in everything he does. People that looked at Moshe Rabbeinu were able to see the greatness and the milos of being close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, there's a famous, it's brought down by the Teres Yisrael at the end of Kiddushin, the Mishnayos of Kiddushin, that a painter once had, it's a question whether or not this is a verified story or a verified medrash, but a painter once painted the face of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he looked at the painting, the king looked at the painting, he was able to read foreheads, and he saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was all the worst meat is in the world. He was you don't want to say such a thing, but he was a Balgaiva. He was an adulterer. He was a murderer. He was a terribly angry person. And everything he could think of, he had all the worst meters in the world. And when you looked at his face, you looked at his forehead, you could see such things. So he went to go visit Moshe Rabbeinu, and he saw that it was the very same Moshe Rabbeinu that they had painted. He said, there must be something wrong. I saw a person who's so terrible, but everybody knows about you, Moshe Rabbeinu, that you're supposed to be one of the greatest people to have ever lived. How could that be? And Moshe Rabbeinu said, that's true. I worked on myself. I grew up in Paro's palace. I had to work on myself tremendously the entire time. Then Moshe Rabbeinu worked and worked and worked, and that's Re'eh. Look at me, said Moshe Rabbeinu. See how I am. See what I look like, and you can see the greatness of a person, the milah of being close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the idea, that Re'eh is individually. In other words, it's not all of Klal Yisrael as in Re'u, everyone should see. It's Re'eh. Every individual can see something in me that they need to work on, that they can find for themselves. So look at Moshe Rabbeinu, and the idea is that look at the Talmidei Chachamim of your generation. Look at those Talmidei Chachamim and see what they have and see what they do, and you'll be able to work on yourself. You'll be able to fix yourself by seeing such great things within them. By doing that, you should be milo yourself to tremendous levels. The Chidush HaRim, the Ger Rabba. One time had a I guess you can call a chassid, a student that came to visit him and stayed right outside the door, and he just stood there. He didn't ask the Chiddush HaRim any questions. He just stared right at the Chiddush HaRim's face. He stared and stared and stared. So the Chiddush HaRim ignored him for a little bit. He's a ger chassid. He doesn't talk when unnecessary. So he let him stare at him a little bit. And after he finished staring, after, you know, 5-10 minutes, whatever it was, Chiddush HaRim said to him, do you need anything? Can I get you anything? Can I get you a drink? What are you doing here? And he said, well, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says in this week's Parsha, the word Re'eh means to look at Talmidei Chachamim. And by looking at Talmidei Chachamim, you'll be able to gain, you'll be able to have this tremendous level, and you'll get this highest level, the highest level that you could possibly imagine. So here you're supposed to look at everything, and that's what I'm doing. I'm looking at you so that I can be on this high, high level. That's what I'm trying to do over here. Rabbi Chiddush HaRim told him, said to him, looked at him and said, the Pasuk says, V'amech kulam tzadikim, that your people are entirely tzadikim, that everyone amongst your people are tremendous tzadikim. You're a tzadik as well. It's better to look at yourself in a mirror than to look at me in order to make yourself into a tzadik. Get the idea? Get the line? The line is that, yeah, you can look at a tzaddik and you can turn into a tzaddik by seeing such milos, by seeing such things. That's possible. But that's not the real level. The real level is to be able to work on yourself and to see yourself in the mirror, to work on yourself at that point, to be able to say to yourself, I can do it on my own. I don't need all these heebie-jeebie types of things to be able to work it out. That's the concept, to look at yourself and to know what to do. That's going to switch us over to another subject. Toward the end of the parsha, it's very strange. Parak Yud Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. The Pasuk says, when you're far away from the place that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides to put his name on there, never, not once, is the name of the Beis HaMikdash mentioned in any parsha, anywhere. There's no mention of the Beis HaMikdash. There's no mention of Yerushalayim. It's just the place that God decides to put his name there. That's where it is. When you get there, and you're far away from there, so you can't go there to bring a korban. So what do? You shecht. You shecht, because you're not bringing it as a korban, so you yourself go ahead and shecht your cattle and your sheep in order to eat from the flesh of that cow or from that sheep or whatever it is. Whatever you want to eat, you have to shecht something. No, there's not one place in the Torah that describes how to shecht, how not to shecht, and what to do with it. It's just automatically assumed from these words, v'zavachta mibchorko mitzonko. You should shecht your cattle and your sheep, that you would know all the intricate halachas that comes with shechita. That you can't press too hard, you have to do it very quickly, you can't just go once, you got to go twice. All the different halachas that are there, and how to make the knife, and what not to do, and all the different pagams, the little nicks that come in a knife, none of them are written in the Torah. That's all assumed from the Gemaras. It's not written anywhere, it's just from this one word of Zavakta. Says Rashi, on this word of Zavakta, it says in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, it says, Zavakta lamadnu, shesh tzibui bizvicha heach yishchot. There is a tzibui, a command in shechting, how to shecht. Vein hilchos shechita shenemru l'moshe nisinai. Those are the halachas of shechita that are written to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. This is the idea behind shechita, that shechita is done all together with something, I guess it's just with a knife and everything else, but it's all given over to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. It was never written down. It was never meant to be written down. So, number one, why is this mitzvah that way? Why is shechita not mentioned anywhere in the Torah how to do it? It just has to be given over from Moshe Rabbeinu all the way. Halacha l'Moshe Nisinai, that's number one. Number two, why did the Kusim, when we knew, did not hold of any of Torah Sheba'al Peh. They only believed in Torah Sheba'al, just the written word. Why would they keep this law over any other law in the Torah? What's with this law that makes it so special that they have to keep Hilchos Shechita? Because we know that the Kusim were big in Shechita. They were big Shochet. So why, if they didn't believe in Torah Sheba'al Peh in the first place? What is that? And also, didn't they have Hilchos Shechita in Mitzrayim? Didn't they already know it before Har Sinai? They shechted the Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim. They brought that Korban Pesach, and then 50 days later, 51 days later, they had Har Sinai, and that's when they were taught other halachos. What's going on over here? How could that be that they were taught at everything on Har Sinai when they already knew it from what they had gotten on Pesach? What's going on with this, and what does that mean exactly? So Rabbi Yaakov answers up the third question. What happened to Mitzrayim? He says, now, they used to kill animals in any way possible. Used to stab it, they used to cut it on the back of its neck, whatever they wanted to do in order to kill an animal, that's how you killed an animal. The Shechita of the Korban Pesach of Mitzrayim was the first time that they were taught to use a knife on the neck of the animal and shecht it in that way. But all the different halachas and the intricacies that come with Hilchos Shechita were never mentioned at that time. They weren't mentioned then, they were only mentioned later on at Har Sinai. So in theory, you could have pressed down and killed it that way. In theory, you could have shechted it with a knife that's not proper to use nowadays. You could have done anything you wanted. Just in Mitzrayim, you have to do it by the neck, and it has to be done right around here, and it has to be in the front of the neck instead of the back of the neck. But aside from that, none of the other halachos applied. That's what happened in Mitzrayim. That's Rabbi Yaakov coming after. He brings a raya or two. But the fact is, that's one little thing. He says that explains a tremendous amount. I always wonder why on Shavuos we always eat milchiks. You have a milchik meal. You always have at least one, and it's usually during the day meal, not the night meal. So the Meforshim give the reasons. The Magen Avraham, the Taz, brings down that it's for the Shnei Tavshilin, that we bring two different types of foods on Shavuos, and it's supposed to be the Shtei Alechem, so we bring two different types. There's fleishiks and there's milchiks. You're supposed to have two different meals. There are minhagim on Shavuos. I don't know if you've ever been to a meal like this, where they eat straight. After davening's over on Shavuos, they eat straight through the entire day. That they go, I guess they're up all night, and then they start at whatever, 10 a.m., 11 a.m., they sleep a little bit, 2 or 3 hours, and they start a meal, and they just keep going. They start off with milchiks, they end off with fleishiks, and they just keep eating all day long. I don't envy the wife that had to cook that meal, but I do envy the guys that were sitting at that meal. That it's just a long meal, 8 or 9 hours long. I've heard of meals like that. I've never been to one. I prefer to sleep. But that's the idea behind it, in order to do that Shnei Tavshilin. That's famous. That's one answer. There's another answer given, a famous answer as to why. They say because meat is midas adin, and milk is midas hachesed, and you'd rather have chesed because God did chesed to us by giving us the Torah and Har Sinai. That's another reason we have it. Or because fleishiks takes a lot of preparation, and they came back from Har Sinai, they didn't have enough time to prepare. The women were all at Har Sinai, they weren't at home cooking, so therefore they, instead of waiting for a couple hours to have their meal, they quickly grabbed out something that was milchik, and they ate something that was milchik. Those are the answers. But according to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, this is another reason. They had never been commanded about Hilchos Shechita yet. They've never been told what to do for Hilchos Shechita. So up until now, all the meat that they had up until now was technically treif. So if they had any saved meat from the day before, it's treif now. You couldn't eat it. So you have to shecht right now for the very first time. Now that's fine, except none of these people have ever practiced shechita before. This will be the first time that they do it in the right way, that they do it according to halacha. There's a halacha regarding shechting on Yom Tov. Normally you're allowed to shecht on Yom Tov because people know what they're doing. You're not afraid of trafing up an animal, and therefore it's not a bad malacha on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to just kill an animal stam. But if you're shechting, then it's fine, because normally you shecht correctly and everything's all good. But if you've never shechted before, you can't shecht on Yom Tov, says Rabbi Yaakov. So on Shavuos day, they didn't have a choice. They came back after Har Sinai. The one they said, okay, what are we going to eat? Somebody's like, let's have some cow. So they all wanted to grab a cow. They started to shecht, and they realized, we can't shecht. We've never shechted before. What are we supposed to do? We can't do it now in Yom Tov for the first time, because we don't know. We might trape up the animal. And it's very likely we're going to trape up the first couple animals that we try shechting, because we don't know what we're doing yet. So they didn't know what to do. So instead of having fleishiks, they ended up having milk hooks. And that's the reason why we have milk hooks on Shavuos, because the first meal that they had on Shavuos was milk hooks and apelashik. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, according to that reasoning, you would only have milk hooks during the day meal of Shavuos, not the night meal of Shavuos. Because it only applies after they were at Har Sinai. After they got Kabbalah Satorah, that's when they were able to eat milk hooks. That's when they had milk hooks. But the night before, they could have very well have had apelashiks. That would be the idea behind it and the concept of what they were supposed to do. So that answers one of our questions. That they didn't happen in Mitzrayim. This is the first time they learned the Halachos Shechita. And they got all the Halachos at Har Sinai itself. And that was that. Okay. But another question. The Kusim. Why would the Kusim keep this Halacha over anything else? They don't believe in Gemara. They don't believe in Mesorah. They don't believe that a rabbi can tell you what to do. It only comes from the Torah itself. If he doesn't write it down, then you have nothing. So why the Kusim keep Halachos Shechita? The answer is, says Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe Feinstein brings this down. If it's Beferush, if it says it explicitly that there's a Mesorah, and then it doesn't explain it at all in the text, that they believe there's a Gemara. But if the psukim seem to be self-explanatory or self-sufficient, those are good enough in and of itself that those psukim seem to explain everything you need to know, then you don't need rabbis adding anything onto it. That was the svar of the Kusim. It was a nice little piece of logic. If the psukim explain everything on their own, you're good. If the psukim don't explain anything, like by Shechita, then you need the rabbis. So they understood that there was a Gemara behind Shechita. From that they said, but it must mean that by other things, there is no Gemara. And that's why they kept this, and they didn't keep anything else. Now obviously that's not true. So why did the Torah do it this way? Why did the Torah write it in such a way that fooled the Kusim? That it wrote it in such a way that it didn't explain anything at all and just relied on Torah Sheba'al Peh? Answer is, when it comes to eating things, we have to be extremely careful about what we put into our systems. Because the wrong things can change your entire outlook on life. The wrong mindset. You eat one trefa piece of food, and the Hasidim stay all over the place. It destroys your thinking process. You're not able to think correctly. You're not able to move correctly. You can't do what you used to be able to do, because you've got a holy neshama. And a holy neshama affected by that food is a terrible, terrible combination. The point where you're self-destruct, basically. And nothing goes well, and you just can't do what you were supposed to do. This is the concept of what food stands for. And by this specific place of Inyani Achila, in which it's telling you have to do Shechita, it didn't want to say anything. Because it knows there might be people that think this is all you need to know. Really, you need a Mesorah. You need as much of a Mesorah as you can get to know what you can do and what you can't do when it comes to Shechita. You've got to have a Shochet that knows what he's doing, that concentrates well on what the rabbis are telling him to do, and not just relies on the couple psukim that the Torah mentions that'll be enough for him. That's the concept of everything. Very similar to, if anybody remembers, the idea of Kedoshim Tiyu. That Kedoshim Tiyu is this concept. You can't go around just eating meat and drinking wine whenever you want, even though it doesn't say so in the Torah. It doesn't say you're not allowed to eat meat and drink wine and get drunk and just be a glutton your whole life. The only reason why you can't do such a thing, the reason why you're not allowed to be involved in such a thing, is because, simply put, Torah says, Kedoshim Tiyu, be holy. This is the idea. There are some things that are beyond the letter of the law, and this teaches us that this idea is true throughout the entire Torah, unlike what the Kusim said. And that leads us to another thing. Rav Eliashiv says a famous halacha. It's brought down in Kiddushin, one of the strangest things in the world. Father is chayav to teach his child a bunch of things. A trade, he's got to teach him Torah, he's got to get him married, he's got to give him a bris milah, give him a pidyon haben, and then, classic, teach him how to swim. Where did that come from? This is Rabbi Yashar's question. I've never seen the question asked in Kiddushin. It seems to be, well, yeah, because what if the guy drowns? Says Rabbi Yashar, how many people do you think drowned back then? How many people were going into the sea? How many people were there that it was such a huge problem they need to swim? I've got a better question. You have a ton of people that hated Jews all the time. There were leastim robbers all over the place. Why not teach them how to fight? A father should teach his kid to be strong. He should bring him to a workout room, give him barbells, and tell him, just lift weights until you have it. He should teach him how to shoot a gun. He should teach him how to protect himself instead of being this, you know, namby-pamby, but I can swim, and that's enough. There are other things that you would think you would have instead of just swimming. So what is the idea of swimming more than anything else? It's much more likely to be beaten up than to drown in the sea, I would assume, especially back then. So what is Zalafa? I'm sorry? Mikvah. Yeah, I'm sure that was a major problem. These guys bathed once a year. The one issue that they might have had, you know, that they would drown in a mikvah. I'm sure the mikvah was about the size of one of these chairs, and they went in. You know, where they have to go in. There's a famous story. If you, Mr. Weiss, who's the garden's grandfather, who was around, he was in Europe, obviously, he was a Holocaust survivor, used to say that in his town there was one little area that they used as a pool for the mikvah, and that was that. It was just rainwater, and they made sure that it stayed as a mikvah. He said the thing was unbelievably muddy, that when you went inside, you came out and you had mud caked all over your body. All over your body whenever you went inside. Mikvah back then was not like a fun experience. But everybody, before Yom Kippur, everybody knew you had to go to the mikvah. Every Erev Shabbos, they would all go to the mikvah. That was without a question. Even though it was disgusting, it was something there. I don't think you had a real problem with people, you know, going inside the mikvah and then going down. So here's the concept. This is Rabbi Yashar's line, and it's a really, really unbelievable line. A piece of wood floats in the water, right? Other things float in water as well. But pieces of, you got that, okay, yeah, some people got it. Okay, but anyway, pieces of wood float in water. But not everything floats. Would you say that piece of wood is swimming? Would anybody call that piece of wood that's floating in the water, would you say that thing's swimming? You would say it's swimming. It's floating. It's going around, but that's definitely not swimming. It's just going wherever the water takes it. That's all it is. That's the piece of wood. Okay, so what's swimming? I'll tell you. It's definitely not this. I'm in a hotel earlier this week, and the best thing about these hotels is that in the middle of the day, usually around 3 or 4 o'clock, no one's there. Absolutely no one's there. So you have the pool entirely to yourself. That's the best time. So we go on a trip in the morning. We come back at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and I take my kids into the pool. There's literally no one around. The whole place is deserted. So I bring the kids in, and I take Ruvi and Nohi, my two youngest boys, and I bring them into the pool, and I'm holding onto their arms, and each one of them, every time I do it, I'm like holding them while, you know, walking around in the water, and they're like, we're swimming. And I keep telling them, that's not swimming. You're not really swimming. I'm just taking you around. Kick back. I don't do what that means. But I just grab them around and just say, you want to swim? Then swim. Let go of me and just keep, you know, float. Do something. Push yourself through the water. But just me holding on to you while you're bobbing up and down in the water, that's not swimming. That's a piece of wood floating inside the water. That's a very, very big difference. What is swimming? The water is a reference, and this is the idea in Rabbah Bar Chana Gemara, the fifth part of Bablaswa. Water is always a reference to the nations of the world, the waves being the other nations of the world coming and fighting us at any time. Fighting against the tide is what a Jew always has to do. Of course, at any point you just give in, throw yourself into the water, and just allow the water to bring you wherever you want to go. That's a piece of wood. That piece of wood is not swimming, it's just going along with everything else. And eventually that piece of wood is going to get broken down by the water until it becomes nothing. It's just another part of the entire sea, another part of the ocean. The key for us as Jews is to swim against that tide, to go up against the waves of the water, and to go against them, to know that every time somebody tries to take us away, the water tries to drown us and put us under, swim, fight back, and know that this is not the way to go. This is not the way we want to be. This is the concept, says Rav Eliashiv, of teaching your kid how to swim. Of being able to understand that not only is it's not swimming, it's fighting when a person needs to fight. And not just floating among all the other nations of the world. And that's why we're always known as fish. The Yidgu LaRov. The Karav Arts. It's the bracha that we give to our kids on Friday night. The Yidgu LaRov is the Lashon of Dagim. We should be like fish swimming in the sea and not like little pieces of wood going around. This is the idea of not being afraid of the water surrounding you. There are two Simani Tahara mentioned by fish in this week's parsha. Fins and scales. And excuse me, because every time I say fins and scales, it always comes out of skins and fails. So it's just gonna happen eventually. So just bear with me, okay? It's fins and scales. What do those simanim mean for us? And quite a day, we don't really get all the simanim tahara. There is a Me'ashiloch and Ishbitzer that goes through each one of the simanim for birds and why they have those specific simanim, as well as animals, why it's chew the cud and split hooves. Birds have five simanim. It's mentioned in the Gemara and Chulin, and each one of them are explained in their own special ways, but nobody really explains the fins and scales. So what are those? What are those types of ideas? What's even funnier is that the Gemara says, if the fish has scales, it automatically has fins. So why did it bother saying that it needs fins? Yagdu Tarviyadir. Now that's great for Uvalatsiyam. It's very, very ununderstandable for this. It just doesn't make any sense. Don't mention it if it's not necessary. We realize it has scales. So why are you bothering to mention the fins? Why would you bother doing it? You don't need fins. It's automatic once you have. So what is the explanation? So Rabbi Yashiv explains it, and it's really unbelievable. He explains...
What if it has fins but no scales?
Not kosher.
I know that. So that's meaning that's why you would...
No, but you only need scales. Once you have scales, you automatically have fins. So don't mention the fins at all, and then all of a sudden you just write, it needs scales, and you're done. It's got fins. You automatically know it. You don't. You have no need to mention the fins whatsoever. Rav Yashiv explains by an irini dachas, which is also in this week's parsha, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet. Perakib Gimel, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Says by an irini dachas. An irini dachas is a wayward city that got blown astray from these B'nai B'liyahu, from these lawless people who came into the city and convinced them to do wrong. So what happens to the city? City's destroyed by fire. Every man, woman, and child in the city, as well as all of their belongings, it's all burned in a fire. What in the world is going on here? You had a bunch of lawless people. Those guys should be the ones who are just destroyed with everything among them. These people of the city, God, they were just led astray. They're just fools. So don't kill them, and especially to kill all their belongings. What did they do wrong? The answer to Rav Yashiv is mentioned in the Pasuk. Asher lo yidatam. They're following other gods that they didn't know. The fact is, you didn't learn enough Torah. You didn't learn enough, you didn't see enough, you didn't do enough. So when you have something like this happen, it's an easy consequence. You didn't learn enough, you don't know what you're doing, in the end, somebody is going to convince you to do something wrong. Because you're not protecting yourself by doing the preliminary measures, those types of things that you need to protect yourself from the outside factors that are going to do something to you. That's what you have to work on. You have to have fins and scales. Fins to swim through the water and take you away from those tides, from those types of waters that can pull you under and that can drown you. You have to be able to swim away. Scales are the fact that you have a protection around you at all times, something that is some type of protection, so that if something comes near you, you are able to control yourself and you won't be affected by it. That's the idea behind what a person needs, and that's why the fish is known as those two simani tahara. Those two things over anything else, because a fish protects itself from that. It's crazy that the only animal in the entire in the entire world that didn't sin during the times of Noah are the fish. All the fish, they didn't sin. According to the Medrash, one Medrash says that there's no such thing as intermarriage by fish, that they're all one creature and somehow that works. But another Medrash says straight out, Medrash Talpios, that they had never been together with other species. That fish do not get together with other species. I haven't fully checked that up. It's somewhat, it definitely is true by the fish in my tank, but you know, it's not a very large amount of fish, I would assume. Talpios, that's cute. But the Medrash Talpios is written about 250 years ago. But either way, I'm sure it was named for that reason. But regardless, the Medrash says that they were never together with one another, meaning they had no connection to one another. What happened? They had the fins and scales. They had the ability to protect themselves from the outside elements that made all the birds and all the animals and everything else sin with one another. They were able to protect themselves and they didn't sin. That's a crazy thing. The fish were the ones who were able to do that, and we can learn from that. And here's the idea. Nobody explains this whole, if it has scales and you automatically have fins type of thing. Maybe what it's trying to say is the following. The Gemara is trying to tell you that if you already have the scales and the protection, that means you must already have fins. Meaning, you don't automatically get protection unless you already swam away from the bad. So meaning if you see that it already has scales and a protection, meaning it has a protection on its body, must be that it already swam away from the bad things and grew the scales. And that's the concept. Meaning, if it already has the scales, it might be true physically and naturally in the world, but it doesn't, the remnants, what the Gemara is trying to tell you is that if you already have the scales, that must mean you already have fins. And I don't even need to tell you to have fins, but yagdo Torah v'yadir. But what's the idea? What are the fins? Learn more Torah. because that's grow in Torah and do more and more and more, and that will make your fin stronger, which will make your scales stronger, and you never can stop, because there's no way your scales are going to be enough to be able to protect you against anything. You have to keep growing and growing and growing until something happens. That's the idea within this. Again, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Fish live in water, and water is Torah, and that's the concept of what we're trying to get at over here. It's an easy concept and something that you can easily figure out. That's the idea of the snapir and the kaskesis and why we mention them completely. I also have an idea of why the kaskesis is written that way as opposed to a keshes. Isn't it interesting? The keshes is the bow that you use as a bow and arrow, and I have a feeling that the kaskesis is the same type of protection. But let's end with this. That Bir Yaakov, I have no idea why I looked up Rav Yaakov Abuchatzera. I wasn't even at home, but it was last night, and I was bored, and I figured I might as well check my Bir Yaakov, because you never know what Rav Yaakov Abuchatzera has to do. Everyone knows that Bir Yaakov is the grandfather of the Baba Sali. He died in around 1886, before the Baba Sali was born. He never saw the Baba Sali. Bir Yaakov was just a nut. You can't describe Mikubalim in a normal way that you would describe normal human beings. He's not even close to being a human being. He was beyond a malach, Bir Yaakov. So he writes a remez in this parsha that obviously remez is Torah. That's the idea. But he says the following. The pasuk starts off when it talks about fish. As zeh tochlu, this you should eat, mikol asher b'mayim, from everything that is in the water. This you can eat from everything in the water. He says it refers to chidushei Torah, a chiddush that a person makes. The only way a person can make a chiddush is if it's built upon something else. If you're relying on another bit of Torah or another line from a Rishon or another line from an Achron, you can't just make up something and say, oh, this is true because I made it up on my own. That's garbage. You have to build it up from other sources, legitimate sources, in order to say, here's a Kiddush that makes sense. Nobody can get up and say, Korach was a righteous man and Moshe Rabbeinu was wrong, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu felt bad for the ideas that Moshe Rabbeinu came up with, and therefore he killed Korach. That's garbage. Because nobody says it that way. Nobody says that Korach was right and Moshe Rabbeinu was wrong. Everybody says the opposite. You can't go up against Rashi and the Ramban and the Sfono and the Rashbam and the Ibn Ezra. You can't go up against all the Rishonim. And especially if the Gemaras are against you, especially if the Psukim themselves seem to be against you. Anybody who builds it up that way is creating worlds of falsehood. And in order to make a true Chiddush, you have to build yourself up correctly. What that means is, what are you able to eat? What kind of chidushim do you have reshus to darshan? Do you have permission to say out? Kol asher lo snapir bekaskasis. Anything that has a raya, he says, that you can see on its skin that it's a kosher vort. Because it was built up in the right ways. Whether it's b'mayim, mayim refers to from psukim themselves, you bring a proof from a pasuk, like something in Mishlei or Kohelis that nobody ever does. Bayam, bayamin, in the seas, that's the yam of Talmud, he says, the sea of the Gemaras. If you learn out from Mishnah and Gemara, you bring a proof from there. Or banecholim, in the rivers, the mephorshim that flow quickly, like rivers, meaning something that's not as understandable as the Gemara or as the Chumash itself, but something that also works. If you build it up that way, then osam tochelu. Those types of chidushim you can eat, you can take those for yourselves. But those that are not, those that aren't, give koach to the Sam and Lily. Sam being the Satan, Lily, I'm not saying her full name, you're not supposed to, the last letter of the name is Saf, but those two are the male and female types of demons, and anything else is given over to their kochos, and it goes over to them to build up the powers of Tuma. By the way, it's interesting that right after that it says it calls them Sheretz Hamayim. I don't know, I'm not, you know how I am with Gematria, I like making them up, but I'm not so sure it always works. Sheretz of Hamayim is interesting because Sheretz is the gematria of 590 altogether. Lily with the Suf is 480. Sam is 100. That's 580. And if you include, and this is a stretch, and I realize that, altogether the nine letters of that seven letters of Lily and Sam's name, the two words themselves and Kolel, you can get to 10 altogether, that's 590. So yeah, in theory, you can complete Sam and Lily to be the Sheretz Hamayim, you can understand that to be, that's what's called Sheretz Hamayim, that you're giving it over instead to them. You know, it's just a crazy little line, Abir Yaakov ends with this, the last line. What do real Kedushim do? He says, the Zohar brings down that Hashem, if a person comes up with a chiddush, a new thought in Torah that nobody has ever thought of, Hashem builds rikim, skies and earth, on top of that chiddush. And what he does is that if the Chiddush is based on real sources, it's Ki'ilu, he takes the Chumash and he puts it right there. Then he takes the Mishnah and the Gemara and he puts it right there. Then he takes whatever the Rishonim, whatever you're basing yourself on, puts it on top of there. Then he takes your Chiddush and builds up a massive tower, and you're the spiral that goes all the way up to Shemayim. You're the spire that goes all the way up on top. That's the Chiddush of each person. And it could be doubled up. You could have another Chiddush that goes the exact same way, the same Chumash, same Mishnah Gemara, same Rishonim. And the more that you're Somech on somebody else, the taller the tower is. That's how great the tower is. Which explains Doeg and Achitofel, he says. Doeg and Achitofel were well known as being Rishonim, because they built Migdals HaPoreach Ba'avir, towers that were flying in the heavens that had no base. They were able to come up with this Torah that had no basis, was not based on anything, and they were full of falsehood. That's the concept of the difference between chidushim that are real and chidushim that are fakes that people are making up on their own. That's the idea behind it. We'll stop with that. Have a great Shabbos.